Orr and I both want the latter. The vault, Cor. Cor's bloodshot eyes widen. We take it, free Megara, take control of the People's Paper, and we tell the whole world what happened today. Our dragons have landed on either side of us, and a dim part of me registers that we've both spilled over, that we're speaking through thick water as if we were drunk. Palor and Morana are wild with our fury. Yes, Cor says. Yes. I reach for Palor's reins, my breaths merged with his snorts of smoke. Find Lotus, I tell him. I'll be there soon. Where are you? There's something I have to do first. Something I should have done months ago.
Annie. I leave Power and Rock on the riverbank, instructing them to meet me back at the cloister as soon as they're finished with extractions, and to tell the other guardians they find. The air above the city is thick and grey with smoke, and the mask inside my helmet so saturated that my coughing continues even when it's lowered. When Ayla and I reach the inner palace, we descend into the fire mouth and circle, peering through windows, until I spot the potted plants of Miranda Hayne. The windows of the Minister of Propaganda are golden archways of light. Ayla and I land on the balcony that once was a lord's dragon perch and hammer on her door. When it isn't answered, Ayla fires. I feel her fire like it is my own. The glass of the door buckles. I slam a fist through, shattering it, and reach inside for the handle. I let myself into her office just as Miranda herself bursts in from the corridor. Antigone! What? Close the door! Miranda's wide eyes flick past me to the dragon, silhouetted on the perch outside her office, and then reaches behind her to pull her office door shut. Dragon lords built these perches to summon with convenience from the firemouth, a design that I'm exploiting today for the first time. I'm standing on Hayne's side of the desk, but I don't offer to change sides. Instead, I place the soot-covered iron wristband on it between us. Miranda looks down at it, then back at me. Did you know the city guard was ordered to fill the bunkers based on class metal? Miranda exhales slowly, then eases herself forward to the chair I've so often occupied myself, and lowers herself into it. I did not, she whispers. I don't believe you. Miranda rubs her eyes, and I realize that they are reddening and wet. I did not, though it does not surprise me. We were running behind on bunker construction, and the golds were nervous. How many were turned away? Too many. She leans forward and places her head in her hands. What about the Southside Massacre? I ask. Miranda laughs softly into her lap. You're on quite the muck-raking tear today, Antigone, she murmurs. Yes, that is something I know about. The city guard was ordered to restore order and did so with excess fervor. By the time we called a ceasefire, it was too late. And then you helped cover it up. Miranda speaks like she has a head cold. I'm the Minister of Propaganda. I did what it took. The First Protector's favorite expression. The job of guardians. Since getting to know her, I have thought of Miranda Hayne as an uneasy ally, despite the department she leads. She has been someone whom I can trust as much as anyone, and more than many of the ministry officials working for Atreus. She can have one chance to explain herself. Why? Oh, Annie, you must understand. Miranda lifts her head from her hands, her eyes bright, as if pierced by what she is remembering. In the beginning, it was glorious. I was there, Megara. Her voice flattens, deadens, and her eyes close. But keeping power is so much more difficult than gaining it. You have to make sacrifices. You keep sacrificing until you realize the thing you've sacrificed is yourself. Miranda's face is bathed in gold from the setting sun, illuminating the lines that splinter from her eyes and mouth. She looks so sad that I almost could pity her. Except for the iron wristband of a citizen we failed, heavy in my hand. Except that this was the only thing that mattered. That we be better than them. And we weren't. The metals test wasn't an answer to the Dragon Lord's dehumanization of us. It's just another form of it. And I've been in denial because it was a system that benefited me. I'm done being complicit. Was it worth it? I demand. Sacrificing yourself? Doing what it takes? It feels so good to sneer those words. I can feel Ayla on the balcony behind me, tensed with my tension, full of the desire to fire. A sad smile curves Miranda's mouth, as if my fury makes her proud. For me, she says, it was. She reaches out a hand to touch the iron wristband between us. Ash comes away on her fingers. She lifts them to study in the golden light. Then her gaze passes to me. But you could be better. My eyes prickle. Right now, that already feels too late. How? Miranda's mouth sets into a strange, sad smile. Stop doing what it takes. Start asking yourself, what's needed? She points to the window and I turn. A strip of sky is visible, blue in the wake of the sunset, with a single fresh column of smoke rising thick and fast from the other side of the fire mouth. The first protector's house has been set on fire. Starting with that, Hayne says.
Lee. The coach house is one of the few buildings in the palace complex made of wood. It catches easily. I stand beside Palor, watching the flames spread, smelling the sulfur of his fire, feeling the heat against my face and flame suit, watching glass buckle, paint peel, logs blacken. Palor lifts back his head and roars his flames into the smoke-filled sky. I watch the front door, waiting for it to burst open, waiting for him. This has needed doing since I returned from killing Julia. Forget high ideals and lofty speeches, revenge delivered over toasts of sparkling wine. This man deserves the justice of a dragon's punishment. Come out, you bastard! A cool voice speaks behind me. It would be more like Leon if you locked the door. Atreus Athanatos watches his house burn from the opposite side of his garden wall. In two bounds, Palor has seized him. His fangs hook on the neck of Atreus's tunic, dragging him over the wall and slamming him to the ground. Atreus lets out a huff as the air is knocked out of him. Palor leans forward, letting out a long, slow hiss that burns. My father is not the only one who has left burning peasants to their fates, I say. Atreus doesn't move, matching the gaze of my dragon without flinching. But I can smell what Palor smells. Fear. It smells good. And then I start saying the words that have been pent up since Julia. My whole life I told myself you were better. But this was better. But the rest of it didn't matter. Not that you had them killed. Not that I escaped. Not even that you would have had me killed too. My voice shakes like it has hit an edge. But in the end, I was wasting my time because you are no better. This is no better. The rich still get fat and the poor still burn. The difference is you have the gall to say it's just. Atreus lets out a wheezing laugh, his chest bucking against Palor's maw. Someone was always going to die needlessly. You begrudge me making an effort to choose the best to survive? Palor hisses again, and Atreus inhales from pain. My answer is so loud it echoes in the courtyard over the crackling flames. The only people who deserved to die today were the men standing at the doors of our bunkers, keeping others out. Atreus reaches up, lays a bare hand on Palor's snout. Palor's nostrils flare. Only, he says. You have always had a too great heart. It does your considerable intellect a disservice. I can feel his hand on us. Its tenderness, like a father's. A year ago I would have wanted it. Now I'm repulsed. The Protector's Guard is materializing on the edges of the courtyard, forming a line around the coach house garden. Crossbows turned on me, on Palor. Atreus lifts a hand, telling them to hold, and then he speaks to me in dragon tongue.
Do you think this is the first time I've been flattened by a dragon? Or had to explain myself to an enraged lord? Do it, Lee. Become what I feared you would from the moment I knew who you were.
For a moment, the old fear stops me where I stand, even though I know he is deliberately stoking it. In the light of the coach house burning, a second dragon lands in the protector's yard. Annie slides to the ground beside Ayla, her tear-stained face dried, her eyes only on me. I look at her and wait for her to stop me. Her eyes are like stars in her face. She lifts her chin. My choice. And it's her eyes on me that give me the clarity to see this fear, which has haunted me for as long as I can remember, for what it is. Bullshit. I'm not like my father. I've never been like my father. And I won't become like this man, either. Your vision of justice is a perversion, I tell Atreus in dragon tongue. The better future you promised this city is a lie. You have failed. You no longer deserve the seat you have usurped. I close my fist and Palor lifts his head. Atreus's chest begins to heave. I will take this city from you, I tell the man on the dirt at my feet. But not as a usurper, nor as an avenging heir. The sky is open, and though I still stand on the ground, I feel I'm already on a dragon's back. I will take it out from under you, as you name me your successor, from your knees, because your people want it and your head. Then I will let death be a mercy to you, just as it was for my father. The fire between us is reflected in Annie's eyes as she nods at me. I'm on Palor's back by the time Athanatos has rolled onto all fours. We're taking the vault, I tell Annie. Annie says, good. Are you coming? Annie looks from me to the protector at our feet, to the city spread beyond us. And then she shakes her head. I think I'm needed here, she says.
Here?
Here, she repeats. We're supposed to do this together, I nearly say. But she looks so full of purpose, her shoulders squared, the wind in her auburn hair and the dragon at her side, as if she has found in this moment exactly what is necessary, as I have. Sadness pierces me like a cloud across a blinding sun. But I am too ready for forward motion to question anyone lingering behind. In the dusk's new darkness, Palor and I make our way through the smoking sky to the manufacturing district, where the vault rises from the center of a still-smoking blaze site. From its roof, the green banner of the Passy already flies, and two dragons perch, silhouetted in the dusk. Around it, a barricade is being built.
27. What's needed? Annie. I have a moment watching Lisa Palor's wings fade on the horizon when I consider mounting Ayla and following him. But for reasons I'm not able to articulate, I know that if Miranda is right, and my calling lies in doing not what it takes, but what's needed, then right now I am needed here. On this side of the palace wall. I go to Atreus. He is shaking, gasping, the terror of a dragon's punishment overwhelming him. It is unnerving to watch the protector, who is usually so cool and composed, double over hyperventilating. Are you all right, sir? He seizes my shoulder for support, and then looks up at me. Piercing eyes widen, as if he only now realizes what it means that I've just helped him to his feet.
Antigone?
I don't ask what he's surprised by. I steer him into the nearest entrance of the inner palace, where the captain of his guard sits the protector down on a bench beside the stairwell. I hand the guard my spare canister of coolant.
Good dragons above!
General Holmes bursts through the doorway, purple in the face.
What the hell was that?
You missed the fun, Amos.
Atreus murmurs as the captain begins to apply coolant to his shirt front.
There's fun happening all over this city.
Holmes waves a piece of paper, a message from the city guard.
The vault's been seized by the Passy, with the help of a few rogue guardians. Cor Sir Marana and Lotus Sir Eustace.
Add Lee Sir Palor to that list, Atreus grunts. Holmes swears.
I'll send Antigone out with the others to retake it. But really, amid everything else going on.
He doesn't hear me when I speak. I have to say it twice. Finally, he looks at me like he's remembering I'm there.
I'm sorry?
I'm not retaking the vault. Holmes just stares at me. Atreus, whose head is tilted back to the ceiling while his captain pats on coolant, lets out a single laugh.
That's an order, Holmes says. You can't refuse an order.
I just did. Holmes's purple face grows, if possible, purpler.
Fine, you're demoted. We'll send whatever guardian is up to your job after them.
That guardian will have to go through me, on the barricade, where I will join Lee and Cor if my services are no longer needed here. Holmes stares at me, and then he explodes so loudly that the captain of the guard jumps.
This is preposterous! First Lee Sir Palor, now you? Your job is to follow orders. I'll grant that's never been your strong suit. My job is to think. My job is to guide this city to justice, sir.
In the garden outside, Ayla roars. Holmes is so startled by my equal outburst that his mouth, which was open, closes. A noise comes from Atreus, and as I turn to look at him, I realize that he's chuckling.
Do not hold Antigone's impertinence against her. She is quoting me.
Atreus pauses, and our eyes meet.
You've seen how the Passy report, Antigone. You would have them in control of the state's newspaper.
I look between these men and wonder which of them conceived of the order to stage bunker admission by class metal, and which of them approved it.
If the People's Paper wanted to publicize the atrocities our soldiers committed today, would you let it?
Holmes doesn't even balk at the word atrocities.
Of course not, he snaps. That would be destabilizing.
I lift my chin, eyes not leaving Atreus's face, as Holmes's answer confirms mine.
That's what I thought.
I leave that stairwell with the first rider's badge still on my chest. My limbs are aching from tiredness as I make my way back to the cloister in the early evening, wondering whom I'll find. Who did not join Lee and Cor on the barricade? Who came back to receive my orders? They all did. The room is dark, save for the fire on their faces, turned toward me. Everyone who returned from the air battle well enough for duty. Rock and his lowborn friends, Power and Darius with their usual patrician posse, Deirdre and Alexa side by side, and Chryssa. You're here? I ask in surprise. I had thought that Chryssa would be with Cor and Lee and Lotus. She sits in a chair by the fire, an arm on each armrest, and flicks a curtain of gold hair as her lips purse. Vigilantism isn't really my style. Rock, beside her, grim-faced, nods.
Where you go, I go, Commander.
He says it easily, but I know it can't have been. Lotus isn't among us, and he was Rock's closest friend.
So, what's the plan? Power asks.
A lump has risen in my throat. There are so few of us, it doesn't make sense to go to the oration room. I can debrief them here. I remain standing, a last push of adrenaline flooding my tired legs with strength. There was a time, a few months ago, when I was skittish about delivering a speech to my peers. But right now, I can't even imagine that. Today there is blood on this regime's hands. There are no looks of surprise, only grim-faced nods. My riders were at the blaze sites. They saw and heard what happened. But the regime is about to be held responsible. We're about to be held responsible. The People's Paper and the Vault are now controlled by the Passy, aided by Lisa Palor and Cor. The paper they run tomorrow will call for change and lead to riots. The kind of riots that the city guard has a history of silencing with violence. I lift one hand and make it into a fist. I don't want another palace day. I don't want the palace overrun. But I want this regime to be forced to the negotiating table. I want it to answer for what it's done. I place a flat palm against my fist like a shield. Until that happens, our job will be to keep Kallipolin's citizens safe.
Lee. The Passy base their operations out of the newsroom of the People's Paper, on the second floor of the vault. The desks of its old employees have been cleared, their papers dumped unceremoniously on the floor. Every single lamp around the room has been lit, and as the night wears on, the room fills. I find Megara crouched on a bench to the side of the room with her arm around Cor, her shorn head bent over his, murmuring to him in Damian. She looks up at my approach. I reek, she warns me. I take a seat beside them. So do I. How is prison? She lets out a hollow laugh. Her fingers, black under the nails, rub small circles into Kor's neck above the collar of his cuirass. His head hangs, downturned, like he has lost the will to lift it. I'm still in armor, suddenly aching to remove it. But I reach for Kor's first. He barely responds when I touch him, unhooking the buckles binding his cuirass, loosening it bit by bit. Megara watches for a moment, then imitates with careful fingers on his other side. Plate by plate, we unfasten his armor and deposit it in a pile beside us, while Kor stares down at his lap. There is only one thing he can be thinking about. I hesitate, then offer the consolation that as a child I remember wishing I could tell myself. It would have been fast, Kor. She suffered very little pain. His face collapses. Megara takes him into her arms again, burying her face in his side. I remove my own armor last. The energy that built inside me, facing down Atreus, is fading fast. Every plate weighs twice as much as it should. When I'm done, I grip Kor's shaking shoulder and lean my head back against the wall behind us. My eyes close. When they open, I'm staring up at Richard Tyndale in a prison smock. He smells of sewer like Megara. "My students," he says, smiling down at the three of us together. I sit frozen. The last time I saw him, he was attempting to get me to contact my family in New Pythos. And then Annie had him arrested. All the ways he looks the worse for wear since I last saw him, gaunt, sallow, shaven nearly bald, are our fault. But he isn't looking at me. Megara, you did it. Megara launches to her feet at the sight of her advisor. Professor! She throws her arms around him. He grips her with one emaciated arm, then takes a step back and indicates her shorn head and his own. We match. Megara bursts into laughter, and it turns to tears. We leave Kor sleeping on the bench when Val Lazar calls our first meeting. Inside the glass-walled office that previously belonged to the editor-in-chief of the People's Paper, he begins to review our position and our numbers, along with Richard Tyndale and the Tyrans, who arrived all together with Lotus carrying suitcases. Poetry professor and poet laureate reunite with the chumminess of old schoolmates, which I suspect they are. Did they not feed you, the bastards? Lotiran demands, squeezing Tyndale's scrawny arm, and Tyndale shouts back, You should have been in there with me, you sly dog! When Lazar's meeting begins, I have it confirmed for the first time that Lotus, Kor, and I are the only guardians who have joined the Passy operation. The others must have stayed with Annie. With Annie? Lotus repeats, confused. Haltingly, suddenly much less sure of the decision than I was when I stood in front of the burning coach house making it, I describe my confrontation with Atreus for the first time and my parting with Antigone Sur Aela. Val Lazar grunts. Would have been easier to kill him, boy. He's right, and the reasons I had not to do it seem stupider now that I'm several miles away in a stronghold fortified by three dragons and a lot of poorly armed members of the Passy. I'm surprised when Richard Tyndale comes to my defense. Not if we're after legitimacy, he says. But Antigone staying could be a problem. Why? I ask. Because it's a power grab, Lotiran says, nodding at Tyndale. She'll be next in line for succession if we're attempting to force Athanatos's resignation. She didn't stay at the palace as a power grab, I scoff. The idea is so ludicrous, I don't know how to begin explaining. even if I didn't fully understand why she stayed with Atreus. I know, as I breathe, that it wasn't for any reason as crude as ambition. Richard Tyndale and Lo Tiran exchange a glance. Lazar speaks first.
The people need one person to turn to as they turn away from Atreus, he says. There can't be a rival candidate for succession, not if we want to avoid a civil war. There needs to be only one beacon, and it needs to shine clearly. Do you understand who we intend that beacon to be?
Lazar doesn't know about the promises I made to Atreus when I bore down on him today. I look through the glass at Kor, slumped with his family on the bench in the main office, numb with grief. His sister lost because our city, its leadership, failed her. Yes, I understand. The time for doubting my own fitness to lead is over. Now is the time to step forward and use every gift my father left me. Voice and face and words. Whatever it takes to free this city from Atreus. But Annie isn't what we're up against, I add. If anything, she's most likely to be a sympathetic ear. She's not our opposition. Megara, who has been watching me with her chin resting on her hand, speaks for the first time. Did Antigone tell you she paid me a visit while I was imprisoned here? Tyndale shifts to look at her, a question in his gaze. When I shake my head, her smile is full of teeth. Then maybe there are some things you don't know about her. Foreboding chills me like a draught of old air. Lo Tiran glances at the slit of a window as the midnight bell tolls. We have 6 hours until sunrise. It's time we begin preparing tomorrow's news and planning protest routes. If you don't mind, Val, I'd like to start making assignments. Tomorrow's paper will be delivered, for the first time in its history, from Dragonback. We write into the early morning. With some misgiving, I rouse Kor to ask him if he wants to pen the main article. The expose about what happened today. Kor's face hardens. Help me? I sit beside him, working through it, line by line, like we did as children over rhetoric assignments. Neither of us acknowledges the pauses that Kor must make as his throat closes, as the words stop, as the sentences he gropes for and gets out through gritted teeth make him weep. His hand shakes too badly, his tears blot too much ink for him to hold the pen. So I hold it for him. After I help Kor with his, I write my own. My flame suit is pulled down to the waist, my shoulder and leg throbbing, but I no longer feel tired. I feel alive. Alive and furious. As if with pen to paper, here, on the edge of a second revolution, the vault in our hands and dragons on our roof, these words have the power to reshape the world. It's early morning by the time our stories are finished, and it takes the next few hours to set them in the great printer in the next room. Lo Tiran directs proceedings with the help of Megara, experienced from her internship with the Gold Gazette. When the first papers are rolled off, steaming, a cheer goes up. The new masthead reads, "The People's Paper, henceforth the free paper of Kallipolis." We pound up the stairs with bundles in our arms onto the roofs where the dragons wait. We clamber onto their backs without bothering with armor, cheered on by the passy crowding the rooftops, and launch into the night. The papers scatter over the moonlit squares and avenues like falling leaves. After that, the tiredness hits me like a wave. When we return to the roof, I don't even make it as far as the stairs. I unsaddle Palor and slide to the ground beside him. A watch is stationed at intervals between the green banners of the passy, but this early in the morning, their voices are hushed. I know, a rooftop again. You'll be back in your nest soon, pal. Palor snorts as if he sincerely doubts this. He curls into a circle that encloses me, twitches his wing, and folds it over me. His scales are hot, and when his wing lowers, the warmth builds like a tent. I stretch out on my side, cradling my throbbing shoulder, and stare up at the sliver of night sky peeking between his wing and his crest. For a moment, the stars spin as though I were still flying. Tomorrow, the revolution's sun will become Lee Sur Palor for all Kallipolis to hear. As I slip into sleep and Palor's thoughts slip into mine, I find them full of Ayla. And then I'm out. When I wake, a line of sunlight is pouring through the slit of his wing. Palor folds his wing into his side as I stir and I sit up, blinking the light from my eyes. The sun has risen. It's quiet on the roof of the vault, but I know that beyond it, the city must be exploding with noise. Sunlight means the papers have been found, means the protests will soon be starting, means that outside, the vault is being scouted by the city guard, and the passy within are preparing to defend the barricade. I'm still in my flame suit. My arm is stiff below the wound, my leg aching. I'm so hungry, I feel my own stomach like a cavity. But I'm not sure when the next meal is, so I reach for a copy of the People's Paper instead. That's when I see what Megara has written.
Annie, my plan is to wait the protests out. Keep the city as well in order as possible while they run their course, and at the end, I, as a representative of legitimate law enforcement, will help broker a deal with Lee in the Passy's name. I assume my plan aligns very closely with the Passy's plan, until I read their first paper. Copies were dropped into the palace courtyards in the early morning before dawn from Dragonback. The guardians who've remained read them together in the refectory over meager servings of porridge. For all my hunger, as I begin to read, I lose my appetite. There are two articles above the fold. One, by Lee Sur Palor, demands Atreus's immediate resignation, an end to the class metal system, and a reinstitution of the People's Assembly. It is authored by Lee Sur Palor, the revolution's son. The second, by Cor Sir Marana, describes how his sister died. I hear myself inhale, as if the air has been punched from my lungs. Cor's workmanlike style is familiar from 1,000 assignments read aloud in class. My sister, Anna Sutter, was asked to wait outside a bunker because of a band of metal on her wrist. She never did well in school. Anna, who was always so kind to me, so matter-of-fact about her place in the world and mine. The poor Sutter family, losing Duck. Now this. Annie, what? Chris's voice. The room which has faded returns like liquid glass. The guardians who sit at my table have turned to look at me. As Chrissa takes the paper from me and sees the headline, her hand moves to cover her mouth. Oh, Cor, she breathes. Oh, no. Next to Chrissa, Power lets out an expletive and spits out his tea. He's checked the article after Cor's. When I turn the paper over, he attempts to cover it with his palm. I shove his hand aside. Below the fold, an article penned by Megara Roper is titled Antigone Sur Ayla, Unfit for Office? It's a character assassination. I read it with numb detachment, vision still blurred from Cor's article, like I'm reading a description of someone else. She begins by describing my interrogation of her in the vault. My own words flash at me from the page. Do you know what it was like to watch? From there, she goes on to describe my notoriously strict enforcement of collections, of ration distribution, and my willingness to fire on civilians, some of whose only crime was stealing grain. Richard Tyndale, the professor whom I reported, is asked to comment.
It is unfortunately common that victims of violence later show a proclivity toward violence themselves. One cannot help but wonder if Antigone Sir Ayla, who suffered such unimaginable trauma as a child, is damaged in such a way. But Megara doesn't stop there. She also explores my rumoured romantic liaison with Lee Sir Pallor, my dragon lord's son, obliquely evoking the sordid history of Stormscourge lords and their serfs. That Lee is a dragon lord's son is mentioned to highlight the fact that Lee proved his loyalty to the revolution in a duel to the death with Kin. The paragraph ends by pointing out that I was promoted to first rider on Lee's recommendation. Megara ends by insinuating that I am unstable, vicious, and ambitious enough to seek to use the current political situation to rise even higher. I've skimmed the article with so little emotion that I'm surprised when I look up from it to find Rock cracking his knuckles and Chrissa wiping her tears as her mouth sets with fury.
This is vile!
It's the truth, I hear myself say. Reading my crimes listed in a row feels like looking at worms wriggling on brown grass with the stone overturned. I did these things, and they were terrible. Was I any better than those guards who followed the orders that resulted in Anna Sutter outside that bunker, her family within, when I fired on civilians despite their screams and told myself it was necessary? Those guards and I were all doing what it took.
It's not true. You're not sleeping your way to the top, says Chrissa.
That's what she's appalled by? I nearly laugh aloud. I impersonated Leon Stormscourge to get a name out of her. If this article plays dirty, so did I. Even Chrissa doesn't seem to have an answer to that.
Did you sleep with him? Power asks.
I start to shake my head when Chrissa lays a hand on my arm.
That's none of our business.
Only when I hear the slight tightness in Chrissa's voice do I recall her history with Lee and realize she's setting it aside in order to stand by me. I squeeze her hand and she squeezes back. Power rolls his eyes to the ceiling and mutters something that sounds like, typical. Rock cracks his knuckles.
Chris is right. This is slander. The Passy should be ashamed.
The others are nodding, and I could hug all of them for their solidarity, except for the sudden thought that makes me feel worst of all. Do you think Lee authorized this? A line forms between Chris's brows. What understanding did you two leave with at the coach house? I don't know. I didn't explain to Lee why I chose to stay with Atreus rather than follow him to the barricade because the reason seemed so obvious. He needed me to run interference from the inside. But in retrospect, my choice to stay could easily have been mistaken for something more sinister, more calculating or ambitious. And with Kor mourning his sister and Lee on the opposite side of the barricade, I have no way to explain otherwise. My eyes are burning, and I think Chrissa realizes from how she squeezes my hand and lifts her chin.
They are hurting. This city is hurting. Hurt people. Hurt people. We must hold our heads above it.
The protests begin later that morning.
Not just in the People's Square. In every square, in every neighbourhood, except for the Janiculum and Scholars Row, where protesters are barred from entry. Even outside the Aurelian walls, the Kallipolans seeking entry protest too. We can hear the shouting from the palace. I feel the familiar clenching in my stomach, the steeling to go out and do my job, as I begin to suit up with the other guardians to meet the mob. That's when the memo is delivered by a messenger who enters the armory at a run, clutching his side.
For the first rider!
In the current climate, the ministry thinks it best for Antigone Sir Ayla to remain inside the palace. It is unsigned, its department unspecified, leaving me to wonder who sent it. Miranda Hayne? General Holmes? The First Protector himself? Do Holmes and Atreus feel vindicated to see that the same freedom I advocated for the press has been used against me? Looking at the tight faces around me in the armory, I remember civilians screaming, and Megara's words describing my actions, and what Miranda said. Stop doing what it takes. Start asking yourself, what's needed? I look down at the memo in my hand and crumple it. To hell with Holmes and Atreus. The spite of the citizens I'm protecting won't be new. I've been accustoming myself to it for months. I can handle a little bit more. I have a city to keep safe. We're dousing from now on, I tell the guardians around me. No sparked fire on the protesters. We're keeping eyes on civilians and city guard, both. Glances are fired around the room, one rider to another, pale faces shining with sweat. Darius starts to speak, and I add, anyone who has a problem with that can stay behind. I reach for Ayla's saddle and my helmet.
28. Aga. Griff. I have 2 days' leave to recover from the airstrike. When I return to duty, I learn that Princess Freyda's visit to New Pythos has been accompanied by a curious change in policies. Humble riders are no longer training with a fleet. Instead, the Dragonborn have begun training with Freyda's Goliathan. I'm still expected to serve Ixion and to work in the lairs. The Goliathan, which must also be fed, requires half again as many fish as the rest of the fleet put together, and her feed must be carted down the footpath to the cove below the citadel where she nests. She sleeps when she isn't flying, and hunts the nearby waters for catch to supplement our feeding. But even so, none of the squires want to linger in the company of a dragon whose eyes are the size of a human head. The first time I report to Ixion's chambers after my bed rest, I find his rugs and desk littered by broadsheets covered in the Kalish script. I can make nothing of them. What's all this, my lord? Ixion seems too distracted to tell me none of my business. They're newspapers from Kallipolis. I decide to push my luck for Antigone's sake. After all, pushing luck is what I'm good at. And how do we keep getting a hold of these newspapers, my lord? But this is too much even for Ixion. Are you going to do your job or keep asking me stupid questions? Well, it was worth a try. I leave him to his reading. My next visit to Antigone is scheduled for the day after New Year's, in less than a week's time. I'm praying to the shrines that she and Leo Stormscourge will make good on their promise to get me Drakthanasia. I feel the accumulated information I have for them weighing on me like a belly full of food. The grounded Norsian riders, the newspapers from Kallipolis spread across Ixion's desk, Freyda here and her Goliathan blotting our skies. I can't be imagining that these are winds of change, and that whatever change it brings won't be good for my people or the Squire's. Freda herself remains a mystery, even as the island struggles to accommodate her. With so much of the citadel destroyed in the Kallipolan attack, the New Year's feast would already be a strained affair to plan. It was going to be hosted in one of the minor Haerelian manors that didn't burn, different from the one that hosted Midwinter. But Freda's presence demands extravagance. So Rhadamanthus invites the Norsian peasants to provide a New Year's gift for their visiting princess. The tradition is that we tithe for our Lord's table at Midwinter, and they in turn offer to ours for New Year's. So gift is the nice way of putting that we're being double taxed this year. Aga breaks this news to me as she sits sweating on the back step over a pail of shellfish that she spent the last few days collecting with the little ones off the shoals. They were to be our New Year's supper. Now she's preparing them for our lords. "Do you think we've enough?" she asks. I take the seat beside her. Enough for Freda to feed oysters to Rhadamanthus's dogs. Yeah, every Norsian on the island's doing this. I've served at enough of our Lord's feasts to know how our offering will be spent. It snowed last night, leaving drifts of maiden snow in the alley that the village children are in a battle to scuffle in. A screech goes up from among them. Aga looks up at once, recognizing the little ones' voices. They race towards us, shouting at each other as they go. "Tell him," Becca says, getting to us first, teary with frustration, "that she did." "She didn't," Garrett insists. Aga drops her shucking knife and pulls them both to her. "Who didn't?" "They're saying," Becca says, pointing over her shoulder at a few boys a little older than her and Garrett. "Antigone didn't care about Norsians, but that's not true. She was trying to save us." "Then how come she was firing on us?" Garrett says. Becca purples. "You don't know anything about anything." She yanks free of her mother and takes off down the alleyway, ignoring Aga's call after her. Garrett rolls his eyes. "Girls," he tells me, lifting his arms in a gesture of exasperation better befitting a teenager than a six-year-old, and then stomps back over to the boys. "Where'd he learn that thing with his arms from?" I ask Aga. She reaches down for another oyster. "From you." I consider this with some satisfaction. "They're all still talking about Antigone?" Aga nods. "Getting it from their parents, I think. I've given up trying to manage it." And less need for her to do so, now that Ixion's ploy was effective enough to make half the Norsians draw the conclusion Garrett just did. "Aga, what if Becca's right?" Aga's knife stills, wedged between the lips of the oyster she holds. She looks up at me. "Griff," she says, like whatever I'm about to say, she isn't sure she wants to hear. But she has to hear. "I've told the squires. I'm straining with every nerve of my being as I await the date. On the other side of New Year's, when I meet with Antigone again. I am done shucking oysters for another man's feast while my own go hungry." Aga needs to know. I take the oyster and the knife from Aga's hands. "Aga, what if next year we didn't have to give our catch to our Lord for their feasts?" She lets out a frightened laugh. "What are you talking about?" "What if we could keep it? Keep it all. No lords, no tithes."
"Griff, what?"
I sound mad. I can tell I'm upsetting her, but I can't stop myself. It's too beautiful a vision, and she has to see it. What if we made it Norcia again, not New Pythos? Put an end to the mines defiling our clan castes and tore down the conqueror's flag. Stop! There's a clatter as she launches to her feet. The bucket of shellfish overturns, oysters and clams clattering across the step. Aga has her hands to her face, her eyes bright.
"Tell me what you're planning," she whispers.
after wanting to tell her for so long, dreaming of it and failing in resolve. I'm not prepared for it to go like this. Watching tears course down her cheeks, even as I struggle to assure her. After I've told her everything, Sparker's key and Antigone on the dunes and the dragon poison on its way, she says, "This is a fantasy that will get my children killed." Aga. I reach for her and she pushes me back against the aging wood of our doorframe. It thunks on impact. "Did you not think of Garrett and Becca? Did it mean nothing to you after Eamon when you said you'd take care of us?" "I am taking care of you. I'm doing this for them, for you." Aga's eyes flash. "Do not say that this is for me when you've never had to tell your children goodbye, not knowing if it was for the last time." She staggers back from me and I slump. Because suddenly that memory of Aga on her knees, kissing the little ones before they followed Ixion away, is too much. Maybe I've never had to do it, but I had to watch her. Aga sinks down onto the step, lowering her head into her knees. Her voice comes out like a drunk, muffled murmur. "I can't bear it. Not again." The world has blurred. I crouch beside her. "That's why we have to do this, so you don't have to." She rocks backward and forward on her heels, arms around her knees. "Could you not just rely on Dilo? He's been good to us, kept us safe." The blurring increases. "He has been good to us, so good to us, but it doesn't change a thing." "That's not enough. You know it's not, Aga. Anyway, he was the one who gave me Sparker's key." Aga exhales into her knees. "Then he's an even sorrier fool than we are." "He isn't. He will be." I don't know how to answer that. "The other squires?" Aga asks. "They know." A tremble courses through her bony shoulders. I place a hand on one of them. "And the dragon poison?" "She's bringing it. At our next meeting." I say this with all the confidence I can feel, as I pray one more time to the shrines that Antigone will make good on her promise, that Leo Stormscourge will get her what she needs as he told me he would, that their help will come before our hour is up. A shadow passes over us and I lift my head. The wings of Freyda's Goliathans sail over us, circling the island, trailed by the Pythian dragons like so many small sparrows in the wake of a hawk. And not a humble rider among them. Aga looks up too, her shoulders drawing together at the sight. And it strikes me how different it must be to look up at the beasts above and know that you are nothing but a target on the ground. Then she reaches out and touches my fingers, tightens her arms around her knees as if to press the shaking from them. When she looks at me, her face is shining. "Truth be told," she murmurs, dragging a frayed sleeve under her nose, "I've been waiting for this conversation for a long time. I'm startled. Since Dilo came that night?" Aga shakes her head, her smile tired, and gives me that look only she can give. Like she's remembering the boy who messed the bed and punched too often, and still sees him. "I've been waiting for this day since they gave you a dragon."
29. The Bunker Riots. Lee. It's been hours since the first free printing of the People's Paper was delivered. Half a day since the Pythians attacked our city and Anna Sutter died. And the Passy are due to march in protest against Atreus's regime within the hour. But before we join them, Kor, Megara, and I are standing in a holding cell on the first floor of the Passy-occupied vault, shouting. I've interrupted their mourning, disregarded their undress, as I brandish the paper on which Megara's smear campaign of Annie is printed below the account that I helped Kor write last night in his sister's name. The cell they've repurposed has a single cot, a heap of ministry-issue blankets, and a slit of a window that streaks sunlight across the room. This is not, I think, how either of them planned for me to find out about their union. But I'm too angry to be bothered by their discomfort. I didn't say anything that isn't true, Megara snarls. She crouches on the cot, a ministry-issue blanket wrapped around her. Kor, in his underclothes, has gotten to his feet as if to stand between us. He looks furious, probably more at the fact that I've burst in on them than at what I'm saying. But I don't care. How Kor and Megara choose to find solace in their grief is not my concern. None of this is Annie. None of this is fair. Take a close look, Kor shouts, at your girlfriend, Lee, because she did all of this. And you know it. Reported Megara, reported Tyndale, fired on civilians, threatened to fire on Megara's whole family. The defeated, barely speaking Kor from last night has been replaced by someone manic. The fact that he's right only makes me angrier. I hold the paper and wrap a hand against the paragraph that makes me want to reach for a hot poker to burn it from the article. She's not some serf I rut with in the field. Megara snorts. Your wording, not mine. I want to seize her by that shorn head and shake her. I speak through gritted teeth. Find a more fitting target. Annie was serving a regime led by Atreus. I understand that you're both angry. Kor explodes. Don't tell me what I am, Lee. Don't act like you've got the monopoly on grief just because shit happened to you when you were a kid. He waves an arm indicating torture and massacre. Because in case you haven't noticed, shit's been happening to my family too. His voice cracks. Megara rounds on me. If you hit him for that, I swear to the dragon. I wasn't going to. For a moment, our heavy breathing echoes on the stone walls. Kor has the grace to look just a little abashed, like he's surprised at what just came out of his own mouth. Megara reaches for a strip of green fabric lost among the bed things and begins to twist it round her shorn head, girding herself up as Southside's daughter once more. The best we can hope for, she says with her head turned, is that she'll be too ashamed to show her face. One less problem for us to deal with. But whatever else Megara might know about Annie that I don't, here I know she's misfired. A few insults in an article would never be enough to cow Antigone Sur-Ayla. Not by a mile. This article hasn't made her one less problem, but it may have made her one less voice of reason within the palace when it's time to negotiate.
Annie, I make clear to the captain of the city guard that lethal weapons on the protesters will not be tolerated. No sabers, no arrows, and no explosives. But I am able to issue no such orders to the protesters themselves. For all we attempt to stop it, pillaging on the edges of the protest sites begins, wreaking further damage upon a city already gutted by airstrikes. Granaries, spared from the flamefall by my tip-off, are ransacked by citizens instead. The rioters tear cobblestones loose from the street to hurl at the city guard and forcibly remove the wristbands of citizens they find still wearing them. I don't wait for authorization from the First Protector before instructing the guard to cease enforcing wristband regulations. I wear a mantle that hides my rank, but all the same, as one of only four female guardians in the Corps, I'm recognized. A name I've heard before, Bitch Commander, I hear again. Also a new one,
the Dragon Lord's whore. Ayla and I do not spill over. The Guardians separate skirmishes with ash, our dragons doused. The Aurelian's small size and mild tempers make them naturally suited to urban patrol. They do the brunt of the work, with Skyfish in support, and Storm Scourgers too, for as long as their tempers hold. Everyone has orders to get in the air if they spill over. I'm aware of Ayla's spikes of fear and frustration, like a second heartbeat. So long as I stay calm, she does too. The protesters don't. Their rage is such that I'm not merely worried about the granaries of the Janiculum and the Inner Palace. I'm worried about a bloodbath. We block the bridges to the upper bank and prepare to cut them. The shouting comes from across the river, from the bottlenecks of the bridges where the city guard and the guardians face down protesters, clamoring to cross from the lower bank. Green bandanas and scarves dot the crowd. Some faces are covered, but many, by now, dare to show themselves. Of the fists shaken at us, not a wristband is in sight. On the other side of the river, two dragons alight at the entrance to Highmarket Bridge. A white Aurelian and pewter grey Storm Scourge. Lisa Palor and Cor Sir Morana. Southside's daughter is mounted behind Cor, the green scarf around her head visible even at a distance. When they alight in the centre of the protesters, the cheering begins. Lee Sir Palor, his armour gleaming, takes off his helmet and lifts an arm. Phrases from his speech float across the river. Everyone is equally deserving. Anna Sutter was equally deserving. Then, as the cheering swells, it transforms into a different phrase, chanted over and over, led by Southside's daughter. Lisa Palor, revolution's son. Mounted on dragonback, we are twice again as tall as those on foot. So when Lee turns and looks across the winter grey fur, I know the moment when he sees me. I sit frozen, wondering for the 100th time if he approved Megara's article, if he believes that I'm unfit for office. Lee turns away and continues.